Good evening. I wanted to begin with some thanks for putting this event together. First, I'll thank Professor William Boyd. We've had cooperation here in organizing this with the Environmental Law Society, the Colorado Journal of International Law and Policy, and we thank Dennis Orfman of the law firm of Hogan Lovells for helping make the event possible. So thank you very much for bringing this together. By way of introduction of our speaker tonight, it would be difficult to find another person in America who has a more thorough and multifaceted knowledge of agriculture than Clayton Yeager. From the field to the market, to the realm of international trade, to the impacts of climate change on food supply, and the related economies. Clayton Yeager has operated a large farming operation, earned a PhD in agricultural economics, taught that subject at the department of the same name at the University of Nebraska, where he also earned his law degree. He was Assistant Secretary of Agriculture and was President and CEO of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, the largest commodities future trading entity in the U.S. and the second largest in the world. He went on to become U.S. Trade Representative, and as such, led the negotiation of the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement, a precursor of NAFTA, as well as playing a key role in the Uruguay round that led to creation of the World Trade Organization. He was then appointed Secretary of Agriculture for the United States and led in setting a new standard for farm bills, inspiring legislation that wasn't just traditional pork. The 1990 Farm Bill gave definition to the term sustainable agriculture. Tonight, Ambassador Yeager, now with the law firm of Hogan Lovells, brings together some of his vast knowledge and experience to look at the implications for agriculture and international commerce on the problem of impending climate change. Please welcome Ambassador Clayton Yeager.
Okay, many thanks. That was a wonderful introduction, much too generous, but it's a great pleasure to be here. And we were just talking about this magnificent building. It's a great credit to your dean in particular that you've been able to, for you who are students, that you've been able to study in a facility like this. This is living right. And it's going to be here for a long time to come. I guarantee you that the law school that I went to or the building I was in, University of Nebraska, would not compare to this if it were improved about 100 times over. So enjoy those comfortable seats. As I recall, ours are pretty darn uncomfortable when I was in law school. And speaking of comfort, I'm going to take my coat off because I function better that way, and anybody here should feel free to do likewise. It's nice to be back in Colorado. As some of you know, I'm a Nebraskan by background, so this is almost a second home out here. We've got lots of connections to Colorado. I won't share all of them with you, but all of our children learned to ski on the Colorado ski mountains and Winter Park and Mary Jane and Keystone and Copper Mountain and Vail and Beaver Creek. And we had a place at Keystone for many, many years. In addition, of course, we had a few football games between Colorado and Nebraska through the years, usually to the benefit of Nebraska. but no more now. We're both moving on. You're moving west, and we're moving sort of east, I guess we might say. So we're going to miss that rivalry. And in terms of Colorado contacts, I even can go back to competing in livestock judging at the Denver Stock Show. So I have memories of years ago doing that as well. and politically lots of friends out here on the Republican side, mostly, of course, but not entirely. And I suppose my closest one would be Bill Armstrong, who was a senator here in Colorado for a good number of years. Bill chairs what is called the Denver Board of the Oppenheimer Mutual Funds Complex, and I chaired for a number of years the New York Board of the Oppenheimer Complex, so we worked together on mutual funds kinds of issues. Well, enough of that. There's plenty of linkages to Colorado. Let's talk a little bit about climate change and agriculture and international trade, and we'll allow some plenty of time for questions. And when you get to questions, you can ask me anything. We can talk politics or economics, whatever you want to cover when we get to questions, or you can talk law firms and job opportunities at Hogan Lovells or in other firms if you wish. And I'll try to cover that waterfront for you as well. Well, climate change. The first question, of course, you have to ask when you discuss climate change is whether or not it's a legitimate issue. In other words, is this anything for us to get concerned about in this country or in the world? I'm not going to answer that question because I'm not a physical scientist. So I'm not in any position to provide an answer to that. I have my own suppositions, but that doesn't mean very much. Over time, science will become more settled. Some would argue, very persuasively perhaps, that the science is already settled, that we have a major problem in this world. But not everybody agrees with that, and I think if you can just look at the political experience in Washington, D.C. over the last couple of years, you have to recognize that the American public is not yet convinced. Either they're not yet convinced that there's a problem, or if there is a problem, they're not yet convinced that we ought to do anything about it, particularly if that would call for the expenditure of significant amounts of money coming out of their pockets as taxpayers or for that matter, as consumers of electricity, for example, if the cost of electricity would rise, particularly as you come out of a recession with some concerns as to whether we're really coming out of a recession. So at the moment, you've got a lot of ifs in the climate change situation that leave it very unsettled, in my view, at least unsettled politically. And so the question is, what then do you do if in a situation like that? Well, let me back up a little bit. I just mentioned to Dennis a couple of days ago when he was in Washington that I had a conversation recently with the Dean of Agriculture at the University of Wisconsin, and she told me that that the crop line, if you will, in Wisconsin has moved substantially north in the last 10 to 20 years. What that means, of course, is that things are warming, which is permitting crops that really need the sun and the warmth to be grown a little further north than they had been previously. Well, if you extrapolate from that across the entire United States and assume that the crop line, in essence, is moving further north, that makes a big difference in terms of what we're looking at, both in, from the standpoint of whether there is a climate change issue. That's pretty good evidence that something at least is accounting for that. And then the question is, what does that do to food production prospects? We don't have time to go into the food security kind of issue in detail tonight, but although I'd be glad to comment on it in the question and answer session. But certainly in the short run, we probably get more food production as a result of global warming. In the long run, there are obviously some challenges involved with that, including water. And I should say water is a big deal in a state like Colorado. I did my doctoral dissertation in water law and water administration, and in fact came out and did pieces of it here in Colorado. So I'm familiar with your water situation and pretty familiar with the water situation nationwide. That's a valuable commodity. And over time, water is going to turn out to be the most valuable commodity of all in the United States and maybe in the world. And the price, right now we have a lot of water that isn't priced at all. It's provided essentially free. That's not going to last for forever. At some point in time, we're all going to start paying for water, and there will be competition for water, which is something that I pointed out in that doctoral dissertation 40-some years ago, and is now all coming to pass. But moving on from there, if that's a piece of all this, one can argue that whether or not we're sure about the impact of climate change or whether there's much there, one can make an argument for prudence in situations like this. In other words, is there something that the world ought to be doing in the way of preventive medicine, if you will, just making sure we're kind of ahead of the game, ahead of the curve, if you will, in the whole climate change arena. So the question, how do you get that done? Well, the U.S. Congress took a shot at it last year, passed a piece of legislation in the House of Representatives that then died in the U.S. Senate. That didn't go over so well. And it was, maybe it was a worthwhile endeavor in terms of just getting the debate underway. But in terms of accomplishment, there wasn't much there. It doesn't do a whole lot of good to pass a piece of legislation and then have it die. And it did. Nor has anything very worthwhile been accomplished globally in the climate change area. Yeah, we've been working on this kind of issue since the Kyoto meetings that are now, 20-some years back. So we've had meetings in Kyoto and Copenhagen and Cancun and all kinds of places, typically involving the environmental ministers who have sought to do something in this area in the way of disciplining greenhouse gas emissions in particular. Well, my comment here to all of this, and this I think is why Dennis was hopeful I would come out here and speak to you folks, is that there ought to be a better way. We ought to be able to do better than we have so far in the global arena and also domestically. I'm not going to go into the domestic side in detail tonight because of the absence of time to do so. But let's talk about the international side. And you've got some international trade activity here in the law school. I understand you've got a course in this area. And that's good. I'm glad to see that. And I've had a long-standing interest and a lot of involvement in international trade and trade negotiations. And the point I was making to Dennis in meetings a while back is that environmental negotiators need to take a page out of the book of trade negotiators. Because trade folks have been doing this ever since the end of World War II. The General Agreement on GATT, on Tariffs and Trade, the GATT, was formed in 1947. And we've had a whole slew of trade negotiations through the years over a period now of 70 years or so in the GATT, which is now the World Trade Organization. And to oversimplify it, the trade folks kind of know how to get it done. They're bogged down in the so-called Doha round of trade negotiations right now for a variety of reasons that we don't have time to go into. But fundamentally, the trade people have done a good job of getting to the heart of trade issues, working through them, and reaching international agreements. And that's really what's going to have to be done in the climate change area at some point in time. And in my view, the environmental ministers who have been working on this issue don't know what to do. They're simply not skilled negotiators. They don't really know how to bring about some kind of an international accord on in the climate change arena. And two, there are way too many of them coming to meetings. You've got, in the vicinity of 150 environmental ministers who come to Copenhagen or wherever it is they have a meeting, and they don't get anything done in negotiating. When you've got 150 ministers coming to a meeting, you got to give each one of them 10 to 15 minutes to make a speech. So it takes 2 days just to get through all the speeches before they even get around to talking about negotiations. That's just impractical. It doesn't work. We have 150 trade ministers coming to meetings too. But what happens is that the key ones pair off and they go off to a hotel somewhere, and they get the negotiating done in a hotel room somewhere with maybe 5 or 10 or 15 of them present. The environmental folks have never learned how to do that. There's been a little of that that's taken place, but not very much. So what you need is somebody that's more skillful at the negotiating table if you're going to get anything done in the climate change area. And in addition to that, you've got to reduce the number of folks who are sitting around that table. In trade negotiations, we have, as you probably know, either bilateral negotiations, which would be two countries like the U.S. and Canada when we did that agreement, or you have multilateral negotiations, which created the World Trade Organization, which is about 150 people around the negotiating table, if you will. But then you have what we call plurilateral negotiations, which means something less than that. And the trade folks have done a great job of figuring out how to make plurilateral negotiations work. In other words, you get the people around the table that really need to be around the table, and you figure out a deal with those folks, and then you figure out how to add everybody else to it. If you've got 20 of them that you really have to get the deal with, you deal with 20. And then if you've got to have another 130, you somehow bolt them on, if you will, to the agreement that the 20 have essentially reached. And that's really the secret to getting something done in climate change today, as it is on the trade front. I haven't looked at the numbers, so I'm not sure whether it's 20 countries that account for maybe 80 to 90% of all the emissions of greenhouse gases in the world, but I suspect that's probably about the number, 15 or 20 countries. That's manageable. And if you can have set up an opportunity for those folks, including countries like China and India that have been the intransigents in the climate change area, then maybe you can get something done. And I guarantee there won't be anything going through the U.S. Congress on climate change if China isn't a part of the problem, part of the deal. And there probably won't be anything past the U.S. Congress unless India is a part of the deal. Now, those countries are going to protest. They've said over and over that they're not going to deal. But the fact is, eventually, everybody deals if you handle them right. And one of the things you need to learn in law school is how to make that happen. And I was making the point also to Dennis and others with whom we were meeting that when you get to controversial issues like climate change, you have people who have different roles. Some of them just want to be lecturers. All they want to do is talk about climate change or debate climate change or write papers on climate change. That's all very valuable, but that has nothing to do with reaching agreements. There are also people who want to be litigators, and a lot of people coming out of law school want to be litigators, and that's fine. And we're going to need plenty of litigators in the climate change arena before we're through, because it's such a controversial area. But the litigators are not the negotiators. A litigation skill is a different skill from being a negotiator. So whether you're a lecturer or a litigator or a legislator, and you can add a few other, a regulator and other categories to this, they all require specific skills. And as you leave law school and go into the private sector, or particularly in public service, you'll find that there are notches or roles or niches for those particular skills but they're all considerably different. Negotiating requires a totally different skill, and because it's one that says, what do you do to get a bunch of people around the table who really don't want to do a deal, whether it be trade or climate change or whatever, but your task is to make them deal. And at the end of the day, all 20 of them sign on the dotted line. And that's not easy. It's not easy at all. But that's where the payoffs come. And that's what needs to be done in this area. Let me give you another trade example of that. Right now, the best negotiation in the world that's being undertaken on anything, in my view, is a negotiation called the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And at the moment, it's 9 countries involving the U.S., one of you of whom is the U.S., negotiating over trade barriers in the Asia-Pacific region. Several countries from here down to the tip of South America, Chile, and then a number of countries going around through Asia, including Australia and New Zealand. So far, 9 countries. The expectation and hope is that, notwithstanding the earthquakes, Japan will join, in which case it will be 10. If we get a Korea Free Trade Agreement through the U.S. Congress soon, as I believe we will, I think there's a good chance Korea will join, in which case we'll have 11 in this negotiation. But that's very manageable. That's a little like what we need to do in climate change. If you can get a trade agreement, free trade agreement, a plurilateral free trade agreement among those 11 countries, you've done something. That's a lot of trade liberalization, and it's a lot of market access opportunities for American business, especially American agriculture, because a lot of those countries are going to buy a whole lot of U.S. agricultural products. So we can get the duties and the non-tariff barriers down to zilch in those in that group of countries, we will have made enormous progress. That whole thing is what ought to be duplicated and emulated in climate change. Different set of countries, but more or less the same modus operandi. And we'll just have to see if that happens. If it does happen, then hopefully you'll have something that is marketable to the U.S. Congress. Right now, you can't go to the U.S. Congress with anything that's out there internationally, because we have no agreement with China or India, who are major polluters. China is the largest polluter in the world today. So you got to figure out a way to bring them into the picture if we're really going to deal with climate change, and if you're going to have something then that has some appeal to the U.S. Congress. Now, just a word on what how you might get there. I think you have to have both carrots and sticks on climate change. On the stick side, you obviously want discipline on emissions, hopefully essentially everybody's emissions. And it's a question of how fast you ask them to reduce their level of emissions. Now, that has an impact on the cost structure of your economy, because it flows through to consumers and businesses very, very quickly. Which says to me that you then have to have some carrots to accompany the sticks. In my view, in the climate change arena, the first thing you do is give some real trade benefits, if you will, to manufacturers of green products, if you will, and to the producers of green services, if you will. You can define what that group may be. But what I would do was propose to bring those duties down to zero around the world, and give exporters a great opportunity to sell green products all over the world and open up that market. That will get the attention of a lot of folks. And then you can add some other things. And of particular interest in agriculture is what are called offsets. Offsets simply means that you pay people for carbon sequestration. And that applies not only to agriculturalists, where you can pay them for no-till because you sequester carbon through no-till practices in cropping, but in the forestry area, and that really hits here in Colorado, you know, every tree you plant, if you will, you can get carbon sequestration credits under a program like this. You have to do that well, and you have to do it so that those offsets are legitimate. But if they are, they can be very meaningful, especially to agriculture. I sat on the board of the Chicago Climate Exchange for a period of time, and we ran an offsets program at CCX, which was very popular with farmers, particularly up in the North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota area, where the National Farmers Union was promoting it. But the Farm Bureau Federation was promoting it a lot also through the Iowa-Illinois area, and it was beginning to gain popularity there, too, until the legislative effort in Washington fizzled, and that, of course, brought the value of the offsets down to almost nothing, so farmers were not very interested. And in addition, farm prices have gone up in spectacular fashion over the last few months, especially. So farmers don't really care much about offsets right now. They don't need them. They're out buying combines and tractors as fast as they can get them. But those glory days may not last forever. And maybe sometime down the road, when we have a climate change program in effect in the United States or worldwide, offsets may have considerable appeal to farmers. And there are other things you can do to create some, you know, benefits, if you will, of a climate change program to accompany the penalties or punishment, if you will, from the disciplines that have to be applied. And all of that becomes a whole lot easier if you have an acceptable global program that feeds into that. And one of my criticisms of the way everybody's handled this until now is that they've had the cart before the horse. We were trying to legislate here in the U.S. and then show the rest of the world what we were able to do in this area and get them to buy on to what the U.S. Wanted to do, in essence. And to some degree, that was pressure from the rest of the world saying, you know, you Americans should go first, and then maybe we'll follow. So I don't really criticize the U.S. Congress for trying to do something before we had an international agreement that would work in this area, but it's a whole lot easier, and it makes more sense from a negotiating standpoint if you could work it out among the major polluters globally and then come back and deal with the U.S. Congress. That's in essence the way we've done it in trade for many years now, and it's worked pretty darn well. Now let me say just a couple words about law school, and we'll go to some questions before we run out of time. I hope you all come out of law school being able to read, write, and speak. Hopefully that shouldn't be too hard to do, and I presume all of you do that already, or you wouldn't be here. But never forget that those traits are of extreme importance no matter what you do in life. You're all going to be undoubtedly are good readers from now on. So it's really the writing and the speaking part. And, you know, it's astonishing to me, and I'm sure it is to others who have been in positions, high-level positions in the private sector and government, how often you get memoranda or position papers that really don't read very well. And it's how often you are in meetings where people make presentations and you say, oh my God, why do I have to listen through this? And I hope you don't feel that way now, but the fact is that is really important. One of the things you get in law school that I think is very beneficial is you learn to get to the heart of a matter quickly. When you're dealing with cases, of course, your job is to find what's that argument really all about and to get to that very, very quickly. That'll be worth your weight in gold as you proceed in your careers. Get to the heart of matters quickly and then be able to figure out what it is needs to be done. Get to the heart of what needs to be done quickly as well. And the time is so valuable in it. And when you're making presentations or putting position papers in front of somebody like me, they've got to be succinct, short, to the point, and right on. If they are, you get promoted fast. If they're not, you're going to say, oh, now what do I do? And just to give you an example, when I was, and I didn't even know this until we had a reunion of my Department of Agriculture team here a couple of months ago. And one of my administrators at that time, who was running all the farm program stuff all over the United States, told me that I had shipped so many letters back to letters that they had done for my signature back to be rewritten that they finally went out and hired three or four letter writers so that they could begin to get their letters through to where I would sign them. But the fact is that's just inexcusable. And this is purely bureaucratic responses, and you can't have that. Can't have that in the private sector either. So you're going to want to learn to write very skillfully and speak in the same manner. I have often told people in speeches that the two most valuable courses I ever took in school, and that school at all levels, were typing and livestock judging. And people say, what? But typing, because nowadays everybody has to type. Pretty soon that's all going to change and we'll do it by talking. Being able to type really fast has saved me thousands of hours in my lifetime. Thousands. Bill, I even typed about half of my PhD dissertation, which was 500 pages long. And at that point in time, they wouldn't accept them if they had any typing errors. If you had a typing error on a page, you had to do it all over. But that's been invaluable. Livestock judging, interestingly, goes to the point that I made earlier about zeroing in quickly. In livestock judging, you have to give the reason that you placed a set of animals, 1, 2, 3, 4, 4, 3, 2, 1, and you present that to a judge who is the official judge, and you have 2.5 minutes to give your reasons. That 2.5 minute experience was just wonderful for me. I'm talking to you for a lot more than 2.5, but I can do a lot in 2.5 minutes if I have to still. And so remember that you don't always get 30 minutes to make a presentation. You may not even get 15. Sometimes that CEO or whoever it is may give you 5. So you better be prepared to get to the heart of something in 5. And if you're going to do it, write a memo. A lot of my fellow cabinet officers says have had rules, if it's more than one page, I won't read it. So you've got to get it down in many cases to something like that. That's enough. I'll stop right there, and we'll take some questions. And don't be bashful. I don't get out here that often. Questions on anything that might be on your minds. Bill, get it started.
So back to some of your comments earlier about food security, and if we accept what some of the projections are in terms of impacts on global agriculture and climate change, then what is already a food insecure situation seems to get worse in certain parts of the world, significantly worse. And I guess the question is, what is the role of international trade and agricultural commodities in moving to that? How is that going to impact trade negotiations and but also this effort to move climate negotiations forward as well?
It's very significant, Bill. Food security is on everybody's mind right now because we're going to have 9 billion people here in 2050 in this world. We got about 6 billion now. We're adding 3 billion more. And more significantly, from a standpoint of demand, a point that a lot of people don't realize is that a lot of these folks that are coming into the picture here are folks that are moving up into what I'd say consider middle income categories, which means they eat a lot better. They want to eat a lot better than they did before. And so you not only have more people to feed in the coming years, but you have a lot more who are demanding to be fed in ways that they consider better than before. So that means we got to produce a heck of a lot more food. And we're seeing some of that happening right now as food prices have climbed. Now, maybe they'll go back down because farmers certainly respond to incentives. So one of the answers to that, Bill, no matter what we do policy-wise and climate change, is that if you give farmers financial incentives, they will produce, and they will produce very efficiently. And that's true not only of American farmers, it's true of farmers around the world. And the fact is, there are a lot of governments around the world who don't provide incentives to their farmers. In fact, in many cases, they provide disincentives because they put in place food policies that are designed to hold food prices down to consumers. They say, we'll take care of the consumers, the heck with farmers. And as a consequence, you have little or no prospect for farmers to do a lot better than they're doing today. And that's why you have a lot of subsistence farmers in places like Africa and many other places around the world, including many parts of Asia. So we need to get rid of some of these programs, Bill, that hold prices down for consumers way more than they should. Maybe they shouldn't hold them down at all, but you can argue that. And put some incentives in there for farmers when you need it, and that'll help. And you ought to get rid of programs that are incompatible with that. And let me give you an example. And this one has some environmental aspects to it. Here in the U.S., we have millions of acres of land in what is called the Conservation Reserve Program. It's been taken out of farm production and from crop production and put into trees or grass. From an environmental standpoint, that's highly desirable, obviously, and is that program is strongly supported by all environmental groups. But you have to ask right now, with food prices where they are and with the concern we have about food production, can we, in essence, continue to pay American farmers hundreds of millions of dollars to take all that land out of production? Or should it come back into production and produce food? Well, the environmental answer immediately would be no. Do not remove it from production. And Secretary Vilsack, who has that decision on his table in Washington on a continual basis, has so far agreed with that view. But then you have to say, well, for the erodible lands that are in the Conservation Reserve Program, that obviously makes a lot of sense. Let's not take them out of the Conservation Reserve and put them into farm production. But what about the non-erodible lands, the really good farmlands that have been put in the Conservation Reserve in various places around the country? And I think you can make a pretty strong argument that under the conditions that exist today and are likely to exist for the future, that we ought to take those lands out of the Conservation Reserve and have them go back into farm production. But that would be highly controversial, as you well know. Now, let me just embellish on the issue a little bit, because what happens every time you get a food security crisis like this, if you can call it that, then people come out of the woodwork with ideas that are just off the wall and need to be rejected. As we put it in Washington, D.C., this is the time when the crazies come to the fore. And they do, and they make proposals, many of which they probably made the last time we had a crisis, and they don't make any more sense now than they did then, but they get a lot of attention, and the media will give these things a lot of coverage. And let me just give you one example. One would be to have reserves of food reserves around the world. And there's always been some clamor among importing nations to expand food reserves. But what they'd like to do is they'd like to have the U.S. hold the reserves and then make them available to them anytime they need them in Japan or wherever the case may be. Well, the fact is we've had food reserve programs in the past, and every time we've put any kind of made an attempt to put any kind of a global food reserve program together, it's been a disaster. The food reserve has been an overhang to the market. Nobody knows when the product is going to come in and out of the reserve, so it affects the marketplace. Everybody feels unsettled. Prices go down as a result of this. Everybody gets mad at whoever is running the food reserve, and it becomes a total mess. Well, now we're starting to see food reserve proposals again. And one of the disadvantages in the short run, of course, if you take it, put it into the reserve and don't make it available on the marketplace, prices are going to go higher than they are today, food prices are, because you're going to take that much food off the market in the short run. So that's an idea that doesn't make any sense in food security. But the answer to food security is food production. And we need to do a better job of that all over the world. And part of that is clearly research-related, and it's biotechnology-related. Our friends in Western Europe don't like biotechnology, and they try to discourage it for any purpose at all. And if you have GMOs, genetically modified organism, food with GMOs in it, you cannot export it into Western Europe, which is a real shame because a lot of African countries are agricultural exporters to Western Europe, and we keep telling the United States keep telling the African countries, you could really enhance your food production if you use biotechnology. And the Gates Foundation, by the way, is heavily involved in trying to make that position in Africa over the last few years. But the African countries are hesitant and so far unwilling to use biotechnology to increase their food production because they feel they'll lose the European market and they don't have enough of a domestic marketplace for agriculture to be profitable. So their reaction is, if the Europeans cut us out, what do? We've had it. So they have to kowtow to the Europeans, which is most unfortunate because biotechnology really is the answer. And it's the answer, by the way, in the drought situation, because biotech is about to produce in a whole number of areas crops that will be much more drought resistant than they've ever been in the past. And you can put these different traits on the seed corn that you would plant or the seed wheat or whatever it may be, a whole set of input traits, all of which will then have an impact on production and really can make a significant difference. So, Bill, the simple answer is that if the world would really go all the way with biotechnology, we could feed a whole lot more people than we feed today pretty easily and could probably meet that need in 2050. Okay, Bankaru. You mean in the Monsantos being unwilling to let people plant the same product?
Or just saying it's artificially high, like if wheat seeds are extraordinarily high, Monsanto going one step back from extraordinarily high.
Yeah. You would. That's a potential problem without a doubt, and can be pretty controversial as a matter of fact. But what will happen, in my view, is that any patents that Monsanto or anybody else has are not going to last very long. I think these countries, companies realize that intellectual property protection is short-term in nature indeed. They can have the patents, but they just don't last long. I'll just give you a specific example. Going back to my tenure as U.S. Trade Representative, I was negotiating informatics with Brazil back in those years. It was a really kind of a rugged negotiation. But the Brazilian trade minister would come in and he'd say, why are we negotiating on this product? And I would say, because you've been stealing our intellectual property and in informatics, and we don't like it. And his answer would be, so? We want to steal your intellectual property. That's my objective. Why would I change my objective? It's a little hard to negotiate under those circumstances when the guy on the other side of the table is very forthright in saying he's a thief and he wants to continue to be a thief. So the fact is, there's a lot of that going on around the world today. I don't think there is. You know, we keep working the intellectual property issues hard because we'd like to establish the rule of law around the world, and we'd like people to respect intellectual property. But you can't imagine how much theft there is of intellectual property. Okay, over here. Sure. And in fact, that's exactly what would happen. I mean, the Russians would be there tomorrow morning after the first morning after the negotiation was concluded. So the answer goes back to my earlier comment. You've got to get all the major polluters around the table. And if anybody is coming up and is likely to be a major polluter, like India, you really got to get them too. Because you can't have a big free rider problem. But the other piece of that, though, that I should have mentioned earlier, and you reminded me of now, is that, you know, what we've done in trade that doesn't apply anywhere else globally in global agreements is we've got a really good dispute settlement mechanism. And this is the rule of law, if you will, in trade. And it's under the aegis of the World Trade Organization in Geneva. And if we feel that somebody is violating a trade agreement that we've signed, we can take them to the through the dispute settlement process in the World Trade Organization. And if we win, they've either got to, you know, fix it, whatever they are not doing, or if they will not do that, if they refuse. Then we have the privilege of retaliating against them, which can be pretty painful too. So that's a lot of incentive on the part of all countries to abide by their agreements once they reach them. I mean, there are nations that do break the WTO rules and basically say, you know, if you don't like it, take us through dispute settlement. And we may or may not correct it if you beat us in dispute settlement. But the fact is that system, which we, the United States, improved a lot in the early round of trade negotiations, is working pretty well these days. And we don't always win. We lost a case just a couple weeks ago where the WTO ruled that Boeing was receiving some subsidies from the U.S. government that are not permitted under the WTO rules. And we, the United States now, and Boeing, are going to have to either correct that or suffer the penalty for not having done so. Something like that will have to apply in the climate change agreement as well. Right now, nobody's been talking about, at least talking much about, a dispute settlement mechanism for a climate change agreement. But if and when one is reached, I think that's an essential part. And I would just, to kind of close that off, say to you that there's not going to be any climate change deal internationally or domestically until after our presidential election next year. This issue will basically kind of sit on the sidelines for the next 18 months or so. But there's no reason why people can't do some preparation during that period, think through what the strategy ought to be to do something globally and do something domestically. Because with any kind of a big problem or a controversial issue like this, you have to have a strategy. And if you don't have a strategy, you're never going to get a deal. And then, as I said, you got to get the right people around the table. Yes?
Can you share your perspective on European Union's efforts on climate change?
Good question. The fact is, they haven't done very darn much. And the Europeans, and you know, I love them, and I've done 10 zillion negotiations with the European Union through the years. Europeans are often hypocritical on issues like this, and they've been very hypocritical on climate change. They are wonderful talkers where climate change is concerned. I mean, they are out front at all these meetings saying, we've got to do something about climate change and we're going to be in the front row, and you can depend on us. It's all going to work if the United States will just do what we Europeans are willing to do. But I'll share with you an anecdote that I've shared with Dennis that illustrates where these folks are sometimes. I was involved with the Earth Summit that was held down in Rio in 1992, and it was a time when the rest of the world was trying to get the U.S. To agree to definitive targets and timetables for emissions reductions, and we had said that we were unprepared to do that, which was a mighty sound decision, because you know, going into the coming years where we eventually had a recession, that would have been painful indeed here in the U.S. But that all aside, I was in personal communication with some of the EU folks at that time, and I can remember a conversation with one of the environmental ministers. I can't even remember which country. And I said, you know, he was trying to encourage me to have the U.S. agree to targets and timetables, and I said we wouldn't do this. And I said, are you going to do this? I said, are you going to sign up to targets and timetables for your country on your own emissions? And he said, of course we are. And I said, well, that's very, very interesting. Do you plan to meet those targets and timetables? Of course not. So the answer is it's just hypocrisy. You know, you sign the agreements, take credit for it. And his other comment was, this was in 1992, and it was what you do between then and 2000. And he said, by the year 2000, we'll all be gone and everybody will have forgotten those commitments. So you know, what difference does it make? So he was encouraging us to sign on with that same kind of modus operandi. And I said, sorry, the U.S. doesn't do business that way. If we make commitments, we intend to honor the commitments. You folks obviously don't. And they didn't. They did make the commitments in Rio, and they did not honor them. So he was accurate. Now, some European countries are better than that, of course, and I think their heart is in the right place on this. And, in fact, as you probably know, the parent company to the Chicago Climate Exchange is in London and is... has been actively trading carbon on that exchange as a result of the European agreements in this area, and doing it pretty successfully, and it's gotten along pretty well. So, you know, to be fair to the Europeans, even though they haven't made all of the commitments that they've signed on to down through the years, you know, they've learned how to make cap and trade work, if you will. And I have to say, and this is criticism of my fellow Republicans, the Republican Party demonized cap and trade when this legislation came through the Congress, and I think that's really regrettable. My personal view is that the most efficient, effective way to run a climate change program is through cap and trade, because it's market oriented. And it's just we got everything upside down from a political standpoint, because you'd think the Republicans, who are normally market oriented, would be the ones in favor of cap and trade. And you'd think Democrats, who are normally much less market oriented, would probably go in the other direction and go for a carbon tax. And here it's been just the opposite. But at any rate, that's kind of reflective of Washington today being in a lot of confusion. That's a long-winded answer to your question, but the bottom line, Europeans do some things pretty well. Some countries are pretty nicely committed to this. Others are not too serious about it. Yeah. Sure. That's a very legitimate argument. I'm not sure I agree with the part that free trade is easier. But we've been trying to get free trade agreements with Korea, Colombia, and Panama from the White House over to the Congress for approval for about 4 or 5 years. So it's been pretty controversial here, mostly because of labor union opposition, of course. In principle, you can build a really good case for free and open trade, because it does provide jobs and stimulates economies. And yeah, for those of us who are strong believers in free and open trade, we'd say, yeah, let's go do all the trade negotiations we can. And I personally am very much in favor of that point of view. When you get to climate change, without doubt, you've got a different culture and a different environment, because you're asking people to do things that they really don't want to do. And at some degree, you're doing this with trade, too, because you're asking them asking domestic firms to accept lower tariff levels or fewer non-tariff measures that are keeping out foreign competition, and they don't really like to do that either in any country. In the TPP negotiations that I mentioned earlier, we've got our sugar people, who are the most protectionist people in the world, saying, no, don't you do anything that would permit more sugar to flow in the United States from the developing countries of the world. So there are individual issues in the trade front that are, you know, pretty tough, too. But the fact is, climate change is not an easy negotiation, and you do have to find a way to get the intransigence on board. You pointed out that here's the way I would do it. The most intransigent people in the world in the trade front are Brazil, China, and India. And so if you're ever going to get a trade agreement to on a global scale, you got to figure out a way to get at least two of those three on board, Brazil, China, and India, then you isolate the third one. Well, the fact is the Indians will never agree to anything with anybody. So that means you've got to get Brazil and China on board, and then you isolate India, which is how we got the Uruguay Round Agreement back about 20 years ago. I think on climate change, you have to do pretty much the same thing. India has basically said, we're not going to agree to anything. And I think you have to force their hands and maybe put some trade provisions in a climate change agreement that would give it some teeth. In other words, you punish India a bit if it doesn't comply with whatever the rest of the leading countries agree to. But I don't underestimate the difficulty and you know, how much we demand of developing countries in the climate change area is clearly subject to question and open to further negotiation, and we've already gone past our time, haven't we? So I will, really good to see you all. I hope some of this will be of benefit, particularly to the students, and I wish you all good luck in your careers as they develop. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.